You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. We've got interviews today with Jeff Andrews. He's written a book called The Shadow Man, which is about James Klugman, the man at the heart of the Cambridge spy circle in the 1960s. And we'll also be talking to Cathy Moore. She's director of the Cambridge Literary Festival. And our studio guest today is biographer and historian Ruth Skerr. Hello, Ruth.
Hello.
Thank you very much for joining us. We're talking to Cathy later on. Are you a patron of the Cambridge Literary Festival?
Yes, I'm very honoured to be an honorary patron of the festival.
And festivals are important. Do you enjoy going to festivals?
Absolutely. I enjoy them and the audience, and I enjoy going and talking about my book as well. I think the Cambridge one has really grown enormously over the last few years. It's a very exciting time.
And Cathy talks about putting writers together. That's happened to you. Have you been paired with?
Yes, absolutely. With Julia Blackburn. That was a very, very clever pairing. And that was one of the earlier events, actually, that I did last year, because my book came out in hardback this time last year. It's just about to come out in paperback now. And it was a really creative pairing and very successful.
Quite nice for a writer, because I guess a lot of the time you're alone in your writing.
Yes, and you see different things about your book when you put it up against another book. And so you can have conversations about technique or different kinds of problems. She'd written a biography of John Craske, Norfolk artist, and so very, very different in period and feel from my book, but nevertheless there were very interesting crossovers that we could bring out.
Yes, in fact we interviewed Julia for this programme about the John Craske book, and both her book and your book have been described as pioneering in
yes,
that
that's right. Yes, so we were talking about the different reasons for experimenting with the genre, and Julia had written novels before as well as non-fiction, so it was very, very clever of Cathy to have seen that she could put us together.
Well, we're going to be talking about your biography, why it is so pioneering, but first we're going to hear your first track, which is The Beatles and Paperback Writer. Why this one?
Because of my interest in literature generally, and the it's a song that always inspired me when I was a child, and I think it's still there in my heart as well.
Paperback writer.
That's The Beatles and Paperback Writer there, and the first choice of music from our studio guest on Bookmark today, Ruth Skerr. Ruth is a writer, historian, literary critic and a fellow of Gonville and Caius College, Cambridge. Her first book, Fatal Purity, Robespierre and the French Revolution, published in 2006, won the Franco-British Society Literary Prize, was shortlisted for the Duff Cooper Prize, longlisted for the Samuel Johnson Prize, and the Times named it as one of the 100 best books of the decade. She was a judge for the Man Booker Prize in 2007 and has written and reviewed for the Times, The Guardian, The Wall Street Journal and the London Review of Books, amongst many others. Her most recent book, a biography of biographer John Aubrey, called John Aubrey, My Own Life, was shortlisted for the Costa Biography Award and has been described as extraordinary by Mary Beard, irresistible by Philip Pullman, and haunting, memorable and unprecedented by William Boyd. Wow, Ruth. Oh,
thank you.
Luminaries saying wonderful things. How did that feel?
Astonishing. I was absolutely thrilled by the reception.
Well, it is a great book. I must say, I thoroughly enjoyed it. For those of us who don't know about John Aubrey, and I must confess, I didn't know an awful lot about him before I read you, but just tell us a little bit.
So he's born a gentleman in Wiltshire in 1626, and he lives through an extraordinary time in English history. The Civil War breaks out while he's a student at Oxford. Then he sees the restoration of Charles II and all the excitement of that period. He gets involved with the early Royal Society, all the experiments that there far into trying to extend understanding of the natural world. And eventually he turns his interest in the past, which is very, very strong, even from childhood, into collecting up all the anecdotes and the stories of his contemporaries, and he transforms the genre of biography in his lifetime. So as a biographer myself, that's the way I really came to be fascinated by him. And he's also an extremely engaging person, and that comes through, I think, as well.
So there were biographers before, but just not like, because he's a very blunt, aren't they? They're quite raw.
Yes, absolutely. He once thought that what we treasure are the details about individual lives. And at his time in the 17th century, the tradition was for very hagiographical biographies, praising past lives, holding them up as examples to the living. And he thought that this was actually, these orators and these poets were spoiling lives and history, and that actually we would want to know the true minute details that make you, you and me, me. And he wanted to pass those on to future generations.
But it's quite scandalous, some of the things he puts in, their illegitimate children and affairs. They must have been quite shocking at the time.
Well, they weren't published at the time. It's very important that what he thought he was doing was sort of compiling a paper museum to pass forward, and he never wanted to do any damage. He didn't want to circulate these scandalous stories, but nor did he want them to be lost. And he thought that in the future people might want to know, and indeed that's true. We do.
And he doesn't judge, does it? It's very factual, you know, that even though he reports these affairs are illegitimate children, he never makes a comment.
I think that's one of the most appealing things about him. I mean, so many biographers do feel that having got that close to a life, they can make a judgment on what it added up to or thing. He's a very fragmentary, and he passes on these details almost as though they're relics of the person, without trying to make an overall judgment about that life.
He's been called the father of English biography. Is that, would you say that he's worthy of that title?
Absolutely.
So where did you first come into contact with him?
I came into contact with him at school, and he was always in the back of my mind. I lived then in Wiltshire for a short period of time, and again, he came back into my mind then. And finally, after having done my first book on the French Revolution, I think I was looking for a book about restoration, about treasuring the past rather than destroying it or overturning it. And suddenly I came back to him.
And what's made your book so different and so lauded is the way it's written, the style and the format, because you've written it as a diary in his voice.
That's right, using as many of his words as I possibly can, and building a scaffolding of my words to showcase really what we have of him. So using those fragments, and sometimes I've compared it to restoring a painting or trying to find a way of preserving what he left us, which is very little hints and information scattered through this paper museum and manuscripts. So to try to pull all of that together and find a form which will make it accessible and available.
It's a very bold move, because you're writing in somebody else's voice. Did you have any second thoughts about that?
No, I did very carefully go through my draft and try to remove anything that was flamboyant or anachronistic or odd that I'd put in there. And even right towards the end, I was still finding things, and I think maybe that's not quite right, perhaps that word wasn't used that way at the time. But that said, I didn't want to try and do pastiche. I wasn't trying to pretend to be him, but I was just trying to find ways of showing his words in this very immediate first person way.
And it is very immediate. How much of the words that we read on the page, what percentage would you say?
So everyone always asks me this question. And it's the right question. It's interesting. And I can only answer it on a line by line basis. It completely varies. It depends. It depends on what the fragment is that I'm using. And sometimes there are whole sentences which are more or less taken from the manuscripts. And sometimes I've had to make a supporting sentence or even small section so that the reader can follow what's happening. either in his life or indeed in the very interesting politics and events of the time.
And how did you come to decide that this was the format that you were going to do? Did you try and do the conventional biography?
Yes, absolutely. So it's very much trial and error. I thought I was going to do a conventional biography, but I wanted it to be exciting. I wanted it to bring him back to life, because insofar as people did remember him, he was as a sort of old man reminiscing about the past, not this young, dynamic, fascinating Aubrey who was such a good friend and so much a part of his own times. So I got a bit frustrated with my traditional version of his life. I thought, well, maybe I could do this as a novel. You know, I'm very interested in novels and fiction, in the boundaries between fact and fiction. But the problem was, it was all about him. And if for a novel you need scenes, you need characters, you need interactions. So just a one person novel is a very difficult thing to write. And suddenly I started to think about Pepys and Evelyn and the other diarists of the 17th century, and thinking what a strong sense of those people we have through their first person diaries. And then I realised that it would be a wonderful way of overcoming the problem of the gaps, because in Aubrey's life, there are months, sometimes even years, when we really don't know what he was doing. And instead of inventing something or trying to pretend those gaps weren't there, with the diary form, I could simply move on to the next part where we do have information, and simply jump from one entry to the next. And that was very liberating.
It's a wonderful book, and what a time he lived through. We'll talk about that. There was the Great Fire, the Plague, the coronation of James II, and he was there. Wasn't he? Yes. Front row seat at all those events.
Yes. Really.
Well, speaking of biography, we'll shift gears slightly now. We're going to talk to Dr. Jeff Andrews. He's a senior lecturer in politics and international studies at the Open University. His latest book, The Shadow Man, explores the motivations and political commitments of those attracted to communism in the 1930s, and in particular, one of those at the heart of the Cambridge spy circle, James Klugman. When I met Jeff just before his event at Heffer's in Cambridge last month, I asked him to tell me more about Klugman.
Well, he is a bit of a mystery figure in a way. He wasn't one of the famous spies. He was an open communist. He was a communist intellectual. And he's crucial to the story, really, because it was his ideas, his thought, his gentle persuasion, which was responsible for recruiting many of the Cambridge spies, like Guy Burgess, first to the Communist Party. And then he was involved in espionage when he recruited John Cairncross, sometimes called the so-called fifth man, or somebody within the Cambridge group who also worked for Soviet intelligence.
So Cambridge in the 1930s, it was a particular hotbed for espionage, or just ripe for recruitment?
You're absolutely right. I mean, the context of the 1930s is crucial to understanding the whole Cambridge spies phenomenon. A particularly unique generation of people, young people from quite prosperous backgrounds in most cases, who were attracted to communism because of the rise of fascism, the depression in Britain, the Spanish Civil War, their first awareness really of working class politics and the situations among workers. It was the first mass student movement, really, and Cambridge was at the centre of it, and James Klugman, along with John Cornford, was the leader of this movement.
What was Klugman's motivation?
He was from a prosperous Jewish family in North London. He'd been at school at Gresham's with Donald MacLean, who he helped to mentor in later years. He was attracted to communism by his tutor at Gresham, somebody called Frank McEachran, who was a very eccentric but inspiring tutor who introduced him to the Enlightenment, European civilization. He was the model for the character Hector in Alan Bennett's play The History Boy. He's a very inspiring tutor. Klugman started to call himself a communist at Gresham's as an outsider, as a way of rebelling against the school authorities. Although Gresham's was regarded as very progressive to liberal parents, many of whom sent their sons there. Don McLean's father was a liberal parliamentarian, as was the father of Roger and Brian Simon. Klugman's father was a businessman. Nevertheless, he was quite impressive in other ways. Pupils were asked to inform on their fellow pupils and confess their own misdemeanours, as it were. So that was quite an austere environment in some respects. And his radicalism grew from that moment as a kind of way of rebelling against the college authorities. I should also say that his elder sister Kitty was a communist before him and was at Cambridge in the years before he went, and in fact married another leading communist, Maurice Cornforth, a pupil of Wittgenstein. So by the time that Klugman arrived in Cambridge in October 1931, he was more politically mature than many of his contemporaries. So he's already had a kind of political upbringing, if you like.
And how did you find out about him?
I'd been researching the Communist Party's later years as a Labour historian, and I came across James Klugman then, dealing with his later period as a communist intellectual and functionary in the Communist Party. But I realised that his earlier years provided a much more interesting story as a key figure in this moment of 1930s communism in Cambridge. He also worked for the Comintern in Paris. And there was a big controversy at that time over his role in Special Operations Executive, where he was responsible for shifting Allied support in favour of Tito's communists. Of course, he shouldn't have been let out of the country as a known communist and rose very quickly in the ranks of SOE. But that got me to think more about his past. And when I read his MI5 file, which revealed his admission that he'd worked for Soviet intelligence, because the MI5 had microphones in the Communist Party headquarters, and he talked about his sleepless nights and all the kind of anxiety being a Soviet agent, a reluctant one in his case, brought. And I saw him really as an interesting character because he was an open communist, not a covert spy like Burgess MacLean and Philby. And he had all these conflicts of loyalties he had to address, being an open communist, being working for the war effort, coming back to Britain, being a suspect at the time of Burgess MacLean's disappearance in 1951, refusing to speak to MI5, although a month before he died in 1977, he did meet Andrew Boyle, who was the author of The Climate of Treason, the book which exposed Anthony Blunt. And you get a sense, looking at the notes of that interview, which are held in Cambridge, you get a sense of him wanting to open up to a certain degree, wanting to try and explain what it was like being a communist in the 1930s. And I think we should probably remember that was a very unusual time where loyalties and allegiances were not quite as clear-cut as they might appear later during the Cold War. For example, there was much criticism of appeasement at that time as well, that the Soviet Union was regarded as a key ally in the defeat of fascism at certain moments. And those were the kind of pressures that people drawn to communism had to face, really.
And you mentioned his MI5 file there and looking at that. How do you get access to those?
Well, the MI5 files, and there have been a lot of recent releases in the last few years or so, are held at the National Archives in Kew. Anybody can go and look at them, and it's an interesting gathering of people looking at their family histories and people looking at security records. They provide very interesting insight. I mean, there's a danger of being seduced by a kind of John le Carré world when you go in, because you read about people being observed and tapping telephones and so on, and they get things wrong. For example, I was looking at Eric Hobsbawm, the historian Eric Hobsbawm's file, and there were 12 different misspellings of his name. The writer Doris Lessing has an MI5 file. At one point, MI5 thought she was running a house of ill repute. In fact, that wasn't the case. So they do make mistakes. But on the other hand, they do provide insight, particularly when there's an absence of family letters, as was the case with Klugman. So, for example, the MI5 had a microphone hidden in the Communist Party headquarters. They photocopied letters to recipients under suspicion. They carried out observation. They sent special branch to Communist Party meetings in the Cold War period. So it helps you to build up a picture, and it adds important insight of telephone conversations, little clues, not all of which is relevant, but does give you that wider insight. It would have been very difficult for me to write this biography without the MI5 files. Impossible, in fact.
And do you think there's still an element of shame or secrecy around this, around that whole time and the whole spy and recruitment and espionage period, Blunt, Burgess, MacLean?
Well, there's a continuing fascination with the spies. In fact, it's interesting that there's still a fascination with people who joined the Communist Party in the 1930s, including people like Dennis Healey and Iris Murdoch. There's also the case with MI5 files that not all have been released. And there's sometimes, not released in people's lifetimes, they're sometimes incomplete. There are some people whose relatives have come under suspicion, have not had access to the files. So they remain a contentious area, I think. I think for the historian, you just treat them like any other official documents with a critical eye, but recognising at the same time that they can be useful.
And for somebody like him, who was maybe living a slightly double life, what were the personal consequences of that?
It's interesting, the kind of life he led. It was a life that was devoted to the Communist Party, certainly in later years. All his friends really were members of the party, and they had this existence which almost ran parallel to, let's say, mainstream British society. So he was part of that. He certainly was somebody who bottled up these questions, didn't discuss them openly. Many people, for example, younger than him, who were in the Communist Party in later years, didn't know anything about his earlier activities. So it must have been a life where there were many conflicts of loyalty. Decisions that he took at an earlier stage, which had implications for him in later life. For example, John Cancross, the Soviet agent he did recruit, was in discussion with MI5 in the late 60s. MI5 tried to set up an arrangement where Cancross could persuade Klugman to confess his earlier role, and they met in a hotel in 1967. But nothing came of it. The whole furore over Philby, of course, in the 1960s. Again, he was under suspicion. So it must have been something that he had to deal with. But I imagine his view would have been, as a communist, that was the reality as he saw it at that time. And so it was a sacrifice he had decided to make. Indeed, in his debriefing to a Communist Party official in 1945, where he admitted espionage, he said he would be prepared to go to prison if that was what was necessary. So he'd obviously made that choice, that sacrifice, early in his life.
Was there ever any retribution for what he'd done?
Not really. I suppose in his case, you know, if the thing had come to court, there's a debate on how much real evidence might have been produced. He was involved in recruitment. He himself, apart from his role in SOE, he was not really in a position like Guy Burgess and Donald MacLean and Kim Philby of working in a senior role in the Foreign Office, for example. I mean, he was working SOE at a particular time. But of course, the irony there is that although he admitted to manipulating documents to provide favourable light on Tito's communist partisans, this was in line with the Allied strategy. And in fact, most intelligence experts now regard the alliance between Churchill and Tito as necessary for the war effort. So in that sense, you could argue that that wasn't treachery. It was a kind of left-wing interpretation of the war struggle. So I think in his case, the situation wouldn't be as clear-cut as with some of the others. But of course, he wasn't to know that. And indeed, had the Cairncross situation became public, then of course he might well have been pulled up and so on. The significance, really, of his role was as this intellectual mentor who provided political authority to that group at Trinity College, but Cambridge generally.
And what is it about this period that fascinates you? Because your next book, I understand, is about communist activity in Oxford. Is that right?
It's a very interesting period. I mean, why was it that so many middle-class, fairly prosperous individual students were drawn to communism? And of course, it wasn't a narrow issue in many ways. It had a lot of influence in amongst the poets and writers. I think it was a remarkable period, really, because of the world situation, you know, the rise of fascism, the Spanish Civil War, the first time that middle classes had come into contact with an organised working class. Remember, in the 20s, students at Cambridge were quite conservative. People are still fascinated by those kind of questions.
And Klugman, not around anymore, but if he was, is there one question that you would like to ask him?
Well, I would ask him about his intellectual integrity. He was a brilliant student. I've been through all his school records, and he was top of the class, double first in Cambridge. And he, I think, had the aspiration to be an academic, but his political commitments took over, as they did for others. And I would ask him, and I know he said this in a Radio 4 programme not long before he died, that he didn't regret anything, but I wondered, when he saw some of his near contemporaries like Eric Hobsbawm and Christopher Hill, historians, wouldn't he rather have been an academic historian, not a party functionary? That was the question I'd ask him.
That's Jeff Andrews there talking about James Klugman, the subject of his book, The Shadow Man. You're listening to Bookmark, and our studio guest today is Ruth Sker, author of John Aubrey, My Own Life. I suppose the obvious question out of that interview with Jeff Andrews is, if John Aubrey was alive today, is there one question that you'd love to ask him?
There are so many questions to ask John Aubrey. I mean, it's a completely contrasting life because we have relatively little information. I would love to know his views on the internet. I know that sounds a very strange question, but he's such a networker, such a collector of information, and so keen to pass it on to the future that part of me thinks it would be fantastic for him to be able to see what the kinds of information sharing that have emerged since his time.
Well, that's one of the things in the book, that he has these manuscripts that are so precious, and he transports them around the country, and they often go missing.
Yes, it's terrifying. So he'll send friends in Oxford these precious manuscripts, and then you get these anxious letters following them saying, you know, did my box arrive? And are the coachman promised me that he would take care of it. And then another letter back saying, well, no, actually nothing's shown up. And you just see the physical vulnerability of the information that is so precious in these collections that he's making. Fortunately, his friend Ashmole persuaded Oxford University to set up the Ashmolean Museum during his lifetime. So he eventually saw that he was going to be able to put these paper collections into a safe place and they would be taken care of.
And Jeff Andrews talking there about the remarkable times that James Klugman lived through, and we talked just before that interview about the remarkable times that John Aubrey lived through. It was an amazing period of history, wasn't it?
Yes, politically speaking. I mean, it's fascinating that resonance actually with the party joiners and the retrospective suspicions, etc. For Aubrey, I mean, not only had there been the Civil War, but then there had been the period of Cromwell and the Protectorate and afterwards the Restoration and the reassertion of loyalty to the monarchy. And with Aubrey, it's very mysterious because during the Civil War, he clearly has very strong royalist connections. But then he is, under the Cromwell period, attending meetings of the Rotary Club with Harrington and the people who were talking about the Commonwealth, and I mean, fascinating openness to the new politics. And then with Charles II and the Restoration, again, very, very close to that. And that's led some people to think that Aubrey may either have been sort of politically indifferent or that he was some kind of change coat. But I don't think either of those is the explanation. I think Aubrey is all about human interest, and he will see the human in any kind of political clash. That's what he will ultimately be valuing. And a very good example is with the portrait of Cromwell that he gave to the Ashmolean, and they didn't really want that. I mean, that was sort of something that would be, you know, very suspicious, perhaps even shameful to have. He absolutely insisted, you know, you must keep this portrait. We must remember what these figures, these human lives have been, even if we don't sympathise with their politics and their actions.
And it's fascinating that he's just literally so close to it happening. His friends get arrested. He's got a front row seat at the coronation. He talks about the crown wobbling on James yes. II's head. It's a unique eye view, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, there are some things he doesn't see very close up. For one example is the Fire of London, and he tells us lots about the chaos after the Fire of London and the way in which that has led to the excavation and the exposure of lots of the Roman remains that are there. But we don't have any evidence of him actually being in London or seeing it, so unlike Pepys, where you get that view. So it's a very honest life, insofar as, you know, there are some things he's fortunate enough to see very directly. There are other things he hears about, and you get that sense of a human life with the events in the background sort of coming and going through that field of vision.
Well, we'll come back to John Aubrey. He led quite a long life as well. How old was he when he died?
So he's in his early 70s, 71.
Yeah, it was a good age then, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
Plenty to talk about. We're going to play now your second choice of music, which is Dido's Lament, Purcell. Why this one?
So this is from 1688, so we don't know that Aubrey heard it, but he certainly could have done. He described himself as a very musical child, and he writes a lot about other people's relationship to music. You get the sense he didn't hear that much music except in churches and things. But this particular track is all about remembering, and I think that is very resonant with Aubrey.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Our aspirations wrapped up in books.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers, and studio guest today, historian and critic Ruth Sko. We're talking mainly about Ruth's book, based around John Aubrey, which you wrote in his voice. How did you find his voice, Ruth?
Well, I looked for his voice in the fragments of manuscript and the letters he wrote, the letters people wrote to him. I found as much evidence for his voice as I possibly could. And then I rearranged all of that evidence to make it a chronological order, so you can see him changing through his life. And what was important to me in finding his voice was that it shouldn't be static. I wanted to see Aubrey age. I wanted the young man and all the enthusiasms he had for his era and his contemporaries and his excitement at their scientific experiments, things like that, to be part of the voice. And then towards the end, it does become a much sadder voice, looking back on his life and lamenting the losses that there have been.
Very reflective and aware of his own mortality.
Yes, absolutely. His own and other people's. So one of the focuses for his biographies is he will always try to track down where a particular person has been buried. And so that's very important to him. And sometimes he'll even tell you exactly where the grave is and which way it's facing or how close it is. So that sense of literally really putting a body into the earth and remembering that those remains. That's something he manages to work into the text of his biographies.
Well, he lost a lot of friends during his life. We say, you know, he lived to a good age. And it's almost certainly every year he's losing friends and acquaintances, some very close friends.
Absolutely. So his mother, in fact, lost the two children who came after Aubrey. So although he does have siblings, they're much younger than him. So he must have, as a child, experienced those losses in the home. And then that continues. I mean, he loses friends when he's at university. He loses friends in the Civil War and the disturbances afterwards. And throughout, there are these the sense of the fragility of life. And also the limited range of treatments for what, from our point of view, are really quite common illnesses. One very moving example in Aubrey's case is when he starts to obviously get cataracts in his eyes. And Aubrey thinks that this has been caused by a mist. And he thinks that he's gone to the barber in Oxford too early in the morning. The barber's only got cold water. He's got to get on the coach to go back to London. And he's had his head shaved. And then after that, this what he thinks of as the mist is getting worse and worse in his eyes. And there's a very moving letter where he says, you know, I can't really see to write anymore. And we know that, you know, many, many people would be suffering in this way were it not the fact that the cataract operation is an extremely simple one now.
It is very moving. How did it feel being in his head throughout his life? It's almost like method acting, isn't it?
Yes, and a lot of missing him when it's yes. Finished. I must say, I mean, he did feel like a companion and a very charming one at that, as we were saying, a non-judgmental, humane, life-loving person. So it's a great privilege to write about someone who comes through so strongly after all this time has passed as a really wonderful friend.
Did your relationship with him change as you were writing the book?
Well, I think it must have got much deeper, and also, like any relationship, it had gone on for quite a long time by the end. So I think I understood much more about the range of his interests. I mean, I always knew Aubrey he wasn't just looking back and trying to remember the past. He was always looking forward into the future as well. And the extent to which he was actually involved in some of those Royal Society networks, the way in which he facilitated on one occasion, even very early blood transfusion experiment that he's very drawn to. So you see him in different from different angles and with all these rich and different interests.
Thank you, Ruth. Well, we were talking earlier about the Cambridge Literary Festival. We'll hear from Cathy Moore now. The Cambridge Literary Festival is now in its 14th year. packed with events this year. Spring Festival runs from the 5th to the 14th of April. And when I met Festival Director Cathy Moore, I started by saying what a big year 2016 is proving to be for literary anniversaries.
Yeah, it's a tremendous year. We're celebrating 400 years since the death of William Shakespeare. We're celebrating the birthday of 150th birthday of Beatrix Potter and the 200th birthday of Charlotte Bronte.
So when you're programming the festival, you take that into account and you've tried to include events that reflect that?
Absolutely. It's a real gift. It gives you a steer. I mean, you've got such a lot of riches out there. To actually have something which gives you a focus is really brilliant.
So what are we doing to reflect Charlotte Bronte, Beatrix Potter and Shakespeare?
OK, well, Charlotte Bronte, we have got the wonderful biographer Claire Harmon, who's written a biography of Charlotte Bronte, and that we're doing in partnership with the Fitzwilliam Museum, actually, this year. They're hosting the event for us, and they're also showing some original Charlotte Bronte letters. So that's a real hot ticket event.
And so this is actually her handwriting?
It is actually her handwriting. So very, very pleased with that. Also, Tracy Chevalier has edited a collection of short stories called Reader, I Married Him, which has got lots of accomplished novelists contributing. Linda Grant, Helen Dunmore, who are joining Tracy for the event. And there's a whole host of literary luminaries who've contributed. And that's selling very, very well. Tremendous anniversary for Beatrix Potter, and we've got Peter Rabbit himself joining us. Yes,
the original
Peter Rabbit. He's going to be hopping around the Cambridge Union Chamber on Sunday morning, I think.
And you've got a number of writers coming for the first time. You've got Howard Jacobson, Simon Callow, Sebastian Barry. That's very exciting.
Yeah, Sebastian Barry particularly, and that brings us to another anniversary, actually, is the 2016 is the 100-year anniversary since the Easter Rising, so we're doing a series of three events to commemorate that and to kind of look at Irish history, and Sebastian Barry is kind of headlining that. But we've got a historical event too with festival patron David Reynolds talking to Ronan Fanning, the biographer of Edward de Valera. And we've also got some fantastic new debut Irish writers.
And it's a longer festival this year.
It is. We've begun to kind of stretch into the week. So we've got events starting on the 5th of April and then going through to the Sunday, which is the 10th. But then we've got an additional serendipitous, really, kind of crime event. Lee Child was coming to do an event for the university. It'd be part of a conference there. So we've sort of extended the festival to incorporate that event too and have added our own crime writing event to it, which is wonderful local writers Sophie Hanna and Christabel Kent. They've each got a new book out.
So how many events in total?
Oh, don't ask me that. I think it's about 70, round about 70. I did count them up the other day, but my head for numbers is terrible. It's about 70.
How do you keep track of all these events and who's chairing and who's coming and where they're going?
It's the bit I'd like to do best. It's what motivated me to set up the festival in the first place, was putting writers in front of readers and creating that, what is a unique event. I mean, if you go to see a film, you see the same film all over the country. If you go to see a literary event, I mean, pretty much every literary event is a unique event, because obviously different questions are asked, but also the combination of chair and writer, I find a very interesting one, and the chair can make all the difference, can take the event in a completely different direction.
It is quite a responsibility, isn't it, pairing writers with a chair. Is that an instinctive thing?
I find it reasonably instinctive. I mean, sometimes I scratch my head a little bit, and, you know, what a lot of people say that we do is make, you know, literary gin and tonics, and, you know, the tonic has got to be right.
Oh, definitely. And you've got a real variety this year, as well as the children's programme. You've got Kate Tempest, Alexo Sale, Jackie Kay.
We've really tried this year, and I'm glad you've noticed that, because Cambridge is a really wonderful place to programme a festival, and we have a very devoted audience, and what we're trying to do is just stretch our audience a little bit and try some more comedy, some younger authors. So like Kate Tempest, for example, she would not normally be an obvious sale in Cambridge. She's got this massive youthful Twitter following and a huge following in London. So we're bringing her to a Cambridge audience to see what happens. And she's selling very, very well, and, you know, trying to reach the younger people who are kind of so excited by her. And on the same theme is Akala. He's this incredible hip-hop rapper. He formed something called the Hip-Hop Shakespeare Company, and it's a way of teaching Shakespeare via hip-hop and drawing comparisons between similarities with hip-hop language and Shakespearean language. fascinating.
Which event are you most excited about?
Probably that one, actually. Probably Akala, because his YouTube clips are awesome. And, you know, he was, about 2 years ago, my son emailed me a link and said, hey, Mum, you need to get this guy involved. Anyway, finally we have. So he's very exciting. He's got a huge following.
And you mentioned programming for a Cambridge audience there. Is that something you've learnt over the years, what goes well here and what doesn't?
Absolutely. I mean, there are certain things that I try each year. And sometimes as I'm programming something, I'll think, this is not going to go down too well. You know, something that would sell out in Guildford or Cheltenham. Cambridge is less celebrity-driven. And if it's a celebrity, it has to be a particular clever celebrity.
So when do you start programming?
Properly sort of 9 months before the next festival. You know, occasionally I'll sign something up 12 months ahead, but generally kind of full steam ahead with 9 months to go.
And there seems to be more poetry in the festival this
year. Yeah, we used to do a lot of poetry. I stopped it because I found it very expensive. We didn't get the audiences. They generally cost me more than we took. And, we're a small charity. We get very limited funding, or some years no funding. So you have to take commercial decisions. I love poetry, and I think there's a very active poetry audience in Cambridge. So this year we've tried again and tried to be quite bespoke in what we have put on. There are a couple of gifts out there currently. I mean, Andrew McMillan, who won the Costa Prize for Poetry, he's joining us. He's son of Ian McMillan, actually, the kind of comic poet from...
Oh, yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
no.
And Frieda Hughes, who's daughter of Ted Hughes and Sylvia Plath, has a poetry book. And then we've paired those two, not because they were offspring of famous poets. It just sort of worked out that way. And we've got a kind of a poetry troupe, but they're not poets themselves, the Raving Beauties. It's performed poetry.
And the children's programme, that's very exciting. You've got Andy Stanton back. He's good value, isn't
yeah,
he
is tremendous value. I mean, he's in the Union Chamber again. Last seen chasing children around the Union Chamber.
I saw him with my daughter. He's hilarious.
Yeah,
he's Mr. Gum author.
Yeah, he's great. And we've got great hopes for expanding the children's programme as well. I mean, we've been very fortunate this year. First time we've had a sponsor for the children's programme in its entirety. Carter Jonas Bradshaw's are sponsoring the children's programme. We've got a couple of events sponsored by, well, St. Faith's School and St. John's School, which is, you know, so it's great. So there's a real kind of interest around it and an injection of money into it, which is what we need, because we strive to keep the ticket prices down because we want as many children to be as involved as we can.
And I suppose as well as the anniversaries that we talked about, politically it's also a very interesting time. We've got the EU referendum coming up and both parties undergoing some sort of internal debates. And you've reflected that in the programme as well.
You know, we always like to cover political issues. We did the EU at the New Statesman debate last year. And this year's debate, we're focusing on the Labour Party, really, and whether a left-wing Labour Party is fit to govern. And that's actually selling incredibly, incredibly well. We also have Ken Livingstone in conversation with Owen Jones. And that will be an interesting chat. Yeah, but yes, there's plenty of politics in there.
And it's in its 14th year now. Does it get easier to programme?
It probably does. I mean, we have got a very good reputation now with publishers and authors for providing audiences, providing not just large audiences, but engaged, appreciative audiences. And so I get a lot more of the publishers come to us and ask whether we'll take certain authors. So yes, it does get easier.
And it seems to have settled into the union.
Yeah, we have settled into the union, and tragically the union is set to close its doors
for refurbishment. Yeah.
So we need to find a temporary home. I think we'll be all right for next winter, but I think for spring 2017, which is not so far away, we need to find somewhere else.
So if anyone's listening...
Yeah. And you've got a lovely 500-seater auditorium, then let me know.
And is it still a buzz for you?
It is, and I had an attempt a couple of years ago at dropping one of the festivals, because it is exhausting programming two festivals a year. But actually, there's a huge appetite for the winter festival, and it's more of a bespoke festival. It's a particular, we don't do political conversations quite so much then. It's more kind of books for Christmas, and it's different, but yeah, I do, I like it.
And it is more buzzy in itself, isn't it, when it's all kicking off in the middle of a Saturday and there's a couple of sold out events and people in the bar and people in the garden. You must wander through there. You must feel very proud of yourself.
Yeah, well, I do. I feel very proud of the organisation. It's a much bigger organisation now. We have a great team of coordinators. We're a charity now, so we've got a really wonderfully supportive board of trustees. It's a genuine team effort. I don't have many staff, but those who are aboard are great, are fantastic, and everybody pulls in. And it is a great feeling. We've introduced the festival gardens in the last couple of years and, you know, try and have music playing in there. And, yeah, it feels great.
That's Cathy Moore, director of the Cambridge Literary Festival. And those dates again, it's running from the 5th to the 14th of April. If you want to find out more about any of the events taking place, some fantastic events, it's cambridgeliteraryfestival.com is the website. You're listening to Bookmark. Our studio guest is Ruth Sko. We're coming to the end of the show, sadly, Ruth. And I just was thinking how it must, you sort of alluded to it there, missing John Aubrey after he'd gone. How did it feel to say goodbye to him?
Well, I suppose I haven't said goodbye so far as here we are still talking about him. I think once you've written a book about someone, they do become part of your life on a more or less continuous, I mean, they're you're asked to speak. And last year was an extraordinary year of going to many festivals, including obviously the Cambridge one, but others, and talking about him and thinking about him in response to the questions. I mean, as Cathy said there, none of these events is exactly the same. Every interview you give, every talk you give shows you something different about the book that you've written and makes you think again about the life at the centre of it.
And you've done for John Aubrey what he did for his subjects, in that you've brought him to a larger audience.
I hope so. I very much hope so.
And being nominated for the Costa Biography Award, that must have been wonderful.
It was absolutely wonderful. And I said at the time there's a special reason why. And Aubrey was one of the first frequenters of the coffee houses in London.
Oh, he spent a lot
so
of time in coffee.
Excited.
Even though he never has any money, he's always in a coffee house.
He's in a coffee house because there you hear conversation, you can read the news sheets, you can talk to people who you maybe weren't acquainted with before. You make new friends. So it seemed extremely apt that there would be the Costa connection there.
And he never married. So in terms of his line of the Aubrey family, there are no descendants.
No, not from him and not from his brother. That's right.
Not even unofficial descendants.
Well, of course, we don't know. It's possible. He certainly had an active sexual life. He may have had illegitimate children, but they're not acknowledged. They're not part of the story in any way. I mean, if so, they are in those gaps that I was alluding to.
And just a quick question about that, because you were judged for the Man Booker Prize. And how was that? How many books, for a start, do you have to read?
It varies slightly every year, but in my year, I think we read over 120 novels.
Do you actually read them all? Or do you, after a couple of chapters in, do you think...
No, you must read them all for the reason that when you get together with your fellow judges, you have to build your credibility of your opinion. So you could read one that you love and you really care about. But if in conversation you have failed to read another one, or you make a mistake about the ending or something, then your ability to argue and convince your other judges is damaged. So you can't afford to be skipping them on the basis of the covers or something.
So 120 books, in what period of time are we talking?
Well, that was, I think it was spread out over sort of 8-9 months. So, I mean, it did end up being, I remember, sort of more or less a novel a day.
Wow. You must have not wanted to read any more after that whole experience.
After that episode, I didn't read any fiction or review any fiction for about a year. That's true. And then I've come back to it.
Well, it's been lovely talking to you today, Ruth. What's your next project? What are you working on at the moment?
I'm going to write about Napoleon next.
All right. OK, well, plenty to go on there. We'll sign out with your last choice of music in just a moment. But just a heads up on what our next show will be. Our studio guest on the next show is poet Rod Mangum. And we'll have interviews with book conservator at the Fitzwilliam Museum, the wonderfully named Edward Cheese. And I'll also be talking to Jan Todd about her debut novel, A Man of Genius. But we will sign out now with your last choice of music, Ruth. This is a folk song.
Yes, it's not a folk song that Aubrey collected, but it is a very old Irish folk song, and he is very interested in folklore. And one of the collections there is in the Ashmolean is a collection of folklore. So this track and the album it comes from, the Andreas Scholl album, reminds me of his spirit.